And I got A's.
You might wrote the speech last night.
And I wrote the speech last night. Hospital. I had AIDS for a year and a half. When I first got sick, I had fever and lots of, and I lost a lot of weight. I was 120 and I went down to 80 pounds. I had thrush in my mouth. I went to Brooklyn Hospital and they told me I had a bad cold. So they gave me some Tylenol and sent me back home. And I was really getting, wait a minute now. And I was really getting sick that I couldn't get up. So my friend helped me to the hospital again. And they gave me some more medicine, antibiotics. The third time I went to the hospital, I just laid on the bed and told them I wasn't going nowhere until I get better. So then they took my blood and told me I had AIDS. I was really scared. I didn't know where I got it from because I know you could catch it three ways. And September 27th, I had a baby named Quincy, and he died. But when he died, they told me he had a kidney problem, and that's why he was losing weight and was really sick. So when they told me I had AIDS, they told me my baby had AIDS then. And they asked me, was my baby father was an IV drug user? And I said no because my baby father told me he never used drugs before. He was 32 years old. He was much older than me, but I didn't have no other choice at the time to look at the age, because me and my mother didn't get along. But it's really a long story. They called my baby father and asked his mother, was he an IV drug user? And she said, yeah. So that's how I found out. My baby father is dead, and I really don't know how he died because we didn't speak to each other for a long while. And I didn't call to find out what he died from. How I found out he had died, the operator called his mother and said a collect call to Shahid, and she said Shahid is dead. So that's how I found out, and I hung up the phone. I was in the hospital at the time. I recently found out how my mother died. I found out from my doctor at Georgetown Hospital. She told me that my mother died of AIDS. And so that was really hard for me. When I used to live in Brooklyn, the doctor told me she died from drinking when I found out I had AIDS. So it's been a hard life for me these past years. But so far this year has been okay because my family understands about AIDS now. before they were scared of me. They were scared of me. My whole family is from Washington, D.C. I have two brothers that in foster care now in New Jersey. I really don't know where, because they didn't tell me. I have a sister, she lives in Harlem. She's on crack right now. And I really don't know where she's staying. But I pray for her all the times, and my brothers. This is most of my story, that I really don't have too much happy and good things to tell. But one thing, the happy thing is that I'm living, and I'm giving up some. And I'm not giving up for nobody. And I hope the people out here with this disease don't give up either. Because if it's not a few people out here that love you, it's at least one person, and you got to make it yourself. Thank
you. There's nothing like a real life story and someone sharing it with you, not just the words, but for you to get a chance and for me to get a chance to look into the life that's been told and to not see the differences, but to see the commonalities, the identical problems and struggles, to see what links you, not what divides you, because the linkages are more important than the slight differences. We would not be black women if we couldn't see beyond the artificial differences. When you talk about women, you're talking about the sexuality, bringing forth children, that's a part of a link with eternity, taking care of the old and the dying, getting past the lies and the deceptions and trying to give something of value to what you've experienced, and that's what these two women are doing today. And there are many questions I think we can just ask either one of them. How are they treated differently, or how have their pathways been different from that of white men? And I'm sorry? Oh, excuse me, I'm rushing on. We have a third panelist. I'm sorry. Please. I'm sorry.
Good morning, ladies. My name is Donna. And Missy, you really touched me too. It's hard. 4 years ago, for myself, I had a friend who died of AIDS. He was my fiance at the time. And he was diagnosed with AIDS at Johns Hopkins Hospital. And 2 months later, he died. And after that, the hospital called me and asked me if I would just be a part of their research project to just watch me. You know, at the time, I would get no results on anything about myself. There was no test out at that time. And I agreed that, you know, I would just be a part of it, and whatever they wanted to do was okay. And it wasn't until 1985, when Rock Hudson died, that the Board of Health, I guess, got serious and decided that they needed to sanction that test to give you the results as far as the HIV virus. And after a year and a half of going to Johns Hopkins Hospital, I still did not feel that there was anything wrong with me. And even after the test came out, I didn't want to know whether I had tested positive or not. But I don't know, it was like every time when it came time to go to the hospital, I would get nervous and scared. Well, you need to know, maybe you should find out. So one day I did ask my doctor, and she says, of course, you tested positive. She says, but you knew that, right? And you know, I took it like, right, I knew. But I didn't, it was still just like hearing it for that first time. And I have been an IV drug abuser. Sometime within that year and a half, I had gotten treatment, and I had been clean for about, I guess, about 8 or 9 months. And that day when they told me that I had tested positive, I went straight back to using dope. I left the hospital, I went to the dope man, I went down Haynes Point, and I almost lost my mind. You know, I found a God of my understanding that day, because I saw my brain like black out, and I didn't know what was going to pull me back together. And that went on for a few more years, using drugs, being in a very heavy denial about this thing. In spurts, I would try to call support groups that I heard about for gay men. And just by hearing a female voice on the phone, they would say, well, you can't come. This is for men only. You know, so there was nothing. There was nowhere. They would come up with little programs over at Johns Hopkins that I had access to, but it was so far away because I lived here in D.C. So eventually, I thought I was going to die out there using the drugs, and I really hoped that I would have. And surely enough, I was dying, but it was not from AIDS, and it was not from this other disease. The drugs were killing me. And I got in Second Genesis somehow. And it was there that I, say 2 years later, that I started to deal with this problem of AIDS. It was there that I first talked to people about what was going on with me, about my fear. And they were there, they were supported. Like sometimes you run into people and they don't want to be bothered. Today, I feel like I've come a long way. It's like really a long way. I don't get mad at people today if they don't want to be bothered with me. It's like something inside lets me understand their fear, and it's okay. A lot of times I have to just stick with the positive. I don't like remembering the things that doctors have said to me, the coldness that they will give you a lot of times, my bitterness towards the medical profession, and I'm very bitter towards doctors. But I don't know. On the other hand, sometimes I feel blessed, you know, like to have come through. I remember that my being an addict is my primary disease today. I work with that. As long as I don't drink, as long as I don't drug, I stand a chance with any and everything else in my life. And then I deal with the issue of AIDS and people that I come in contact with. Today, I know I have genuine friends. I know who the people are who don't want to be bothered with me, and they don't have to be. And that's more than I've ever had in my life. You know, I worry about my family. Like when I come to groups like this and I expose me, I always wonder if one of you is going to know my mother or my father and be shocked that I'm up here and what it's going to do to them in their lives. My family is supportive of me, but I don't really know, like Cheryl says, she's dealt with her family. I don't really know how they'd feel if someone came to them about me. You know, I've asked my daughter what is her greatest fear, and she told me she's afraid that I won't be here to see her get married, that I won't see my grandchildren. She's 17 years old. And that was like a shock to me. You know, I didn't know where her mind was just hearing those kinds of things. Today, I work for Second Genesis Project Safe Outreach Program. And we go out there to all of those drug spots, and we take those addicts and we educate them about AIDS. And we teach them about what those drugs will do to your life as far as exposing you to the virus, the sexual practices that you have to correct so that you don't spread it on, or protecting yourself. And it feels good. You know, it really feels good. People do not know about AIDS. You know, you get flashes on the TV and they say AIDS kills, and then they give you this hotline number to call. And I wonder how many people in here have ever really called that number.
I have.
Have you? Okay. Okay, and you know, and I just look at the message that they give when they do that. And like I said, I've never called, because the numbers that I've called, they gave me such down information, I couldn't handle it. You know, I don't do it. But I don't know, my thing is to just, you know, like get around to people and try to say, even with AIDS, even being HIV positive, there's hope. The last year of my life has been great. It has felt good. I've gotten into that positive thing for self, because it had to start with me. There was no outside anything for me, and it had to come from within. And I try to share that message with other people. The past week has been the worst that I have felt as far as believing this being related to my virus. I'm very short of breath right now. My chest is extremely tight. This past weekend, like, I wake up where I can hardly breathe, and running fevers at night lately. And, you know, Cheryl was telling me this morning that I do need to go to the doctor and see what's going on, because it could be pneumonia setting in. And the process does scare me. It's going to be all right. You know, I have to keep saying to myself, no matter what, it's going to be all right, and I'll be strong enough. And just being here today to see all of you women, it feels so good to me. You know, I started a support group for women with Narcotics Anonymous 2 weeks ago. And it was me and one other woman. And then last week, it was me and two more women. And now it's me and it's all of you here. Mm-hmm. And I need that. I need that. I need y'all here. Feels good. That's all I have.
I just want to say that, as the Bible says, with all thy getting, get understanding. And I'm 60 years old, and it's only since my 60th birthday in June. I'm named June for that reason. They just ran out of names. And I've joined AA, and it's the second time around. I tried it a couple of years ago, and I didn't fit. And I found fault with everybody, all the differences, you know. I was never in jail. I never got arrested for DWI, and as my niece told me, but you should have, you know. And then this time around, it's a personal thing, and it's a family thing, and it comes back to me personally again. And I'm going to be with you in that support group. Because what I've really found out is that addiction is addiction. And, you know, it can take one form with one person. Your body's different. Nobody has your same thumbprint. Your identical twin is different. She's got some kind of difference in her body from you, in her brain, in her blood chemistry, in the way she digests food and all. And certainly in the way that she cannot handle drugs. And drugs are drugs. Alcohol is the biggest drug. And it's legal. And it's glamorous. And if we had to get that for $50 a day, let's buy tomato juice and orange juice and so forth. Those who want it and those who can do other things, do that. But I was told this time around in AA that you don't give away any secrets by talking about yourself. It's strengthening. You're not supposed to talk about others, but you can talk about self. And I work for DC government, and I'm very glad that I do. And I went to the meetings the first time I got back in it. And about the fifth meeting, I saw some people I knew who were having another meeting. Excuse me for saying this, but I think you'll understand. And then there happened to be a little luncheon for a secretary that was leaving. And so one of these ladies who was not there for AA or anything, but who was there for a business meeting, saw me at this luncheon for the secretary who was leaving. And so she came over and said, Dr. Butts, you do counseling, don't you? And I said, yes, I'm a family counselor, sex therapist, and all that, in my private, you know, life. And she said, well, you're there to work with those AA people? I said, no, I'm there because I'm in it. And I think she looked at me like I was speaking Greek, but that's all right. You know, it'll just take a time to register. And you never know who needs that message and who is waiting for a helping hand. It may be trembling, but it's out there. And addiction is addiction. And we black people don't need it. And we're suffering from it. So I want to get on with your reactions. First of all, I do want to ask Cheryl, Missy, and Donna, and please excuse me for rushing past. Your contribution was most valuable. If each of you would think about these big questions and share with us your insight on what do you think are the differences between black women with AIDS and men with AIDS, white, gay, even black men, but the difference between black women and men. Thank you. Any one of you, if you feel like sharing it, we'll pass the mic. Mm-hmm. Just a word, you don't want to talk, Kevin. Thank you.
For one thing, a man is a man and a woman is a woman. My reproductive system, which a man does not have, is not tolerant of AIDS. I mean, now I used to have a regular monthly cycle, like clockwork. NAS every 2 weeks. My mood, I guess it's your mood or your depression, PMS, I got AMS. A whole lot of just different symptoms that do not show up in men, period. Whether they're gay, straight, black, or white. I would even be hesitant to say a white woman suffers AIDS the same way a black woman does. Because we've always, well, at least I was taught and brought up that way, that black women always had to be the strong ones, the backbones, and be this and be that. And so you tend to, like, sort of push your illnesses to the side, trying to deal with something else. And with me coming down with AIDS, because before I started getting sick, I was a very outgoing, robust, athletic person. I couldn't run to that door now and wouldn't try. So I know I do know there are differences as far as getting clinical about it and all that. I have to sit down and think about it and go into detail, but there are obvious differences.
I think that what Cheryl said just initially, just by the fact that we're women and black women, makes it hard for us. Anything that a woman sets out to do, she's got to fight twice as hard, twice as long, scream 10 times louder. And I don't know, I find that, like, within my black community, like when I'm doing those researches out there on the streets with the addicts, our black churches don't support AIDS. I have yet to have found the first person that has heard anything whatsoever in a church or a temple related to AIDS. I don't know, we as blacks, like with our black families, I think because of the way that you get this disease, the stereotype, because it's through IV drug use, sexual transmission, that makes it bad right there. So your families don't want to talk about it. You know, you don't want to hear about how you got this terrible thing. And we have to break some of those barriers. I don't know if that's just unique to women. I find it especially hard because I want to be I'm a black woman. I have a career, and I like to think of it as a career, you know, something that has status to it. But I'm HIV positive, and that's been, like, stereotyped in the negative, you know, so, I don't know, that's kind of my thought.
Okay, another question, what can we do to help? And do you need some questions from the audience at this point?
Oh, yeah, you can, feel free. Mom, if you would ask me, what could you do now? Volunteer, start talking. You might not, I'm not saying call me if you don't want to, but, you know, just start reaching out. I'm not saying by next week you're going to be an AIDS expert, but just start talking about it. Among the black community, but with anybody that's willing to listen. And if it'll help you deal with it, talk to one of them winos on the corner, or, you know, anybody, bus driver, anything. Anything that'll make you willing to open up and question why is AIDS ravishing the black, because they eating up the black community, and people just ain't saying. And to me, that's a form of genocide, but they not meant, white people just ain't mentioning. And we're going to look around, and we're going to be extinct for the simple fact that we tried to push it up under the car.
Yes, please. This sister right there. Probably in the white and in the red.
Okay.
Would you stand?
Sure.
The question I have is, our relationships with black men need to be more honest, or in the absence of that honesty, we need to find different ways to cope with them so that we don't put ourselves at greater risk. And I was wondering if you had any suggestions on how to increase honesty with your husband or your lover or your boyfriend, or in the absence of that, how do you convince somebody that it might be wise to practice safe sex or to abstain or whatever might be the solution?
Did everybody hear the question?
That has been the hardest thing for me to deal with, to to accept the fact that I'm HIV positive and that I have a responsibility to protect my partner. When the guilt has gotten so bad, and then I could share with my black male what was wrong with me and whatever, and he go through his process of screaming and hollering and whatever, then I become the object of ridicule. You know, I found myself take on a lot of things that I don't have to take, you know, just by the mere, you know, I've been humiliated, intimidated, physically and emotionally abused by my black men. And some of it I look at now is that, yes, it is their ignorance. You know, like today, I try to educate them. You know, I say to my friend, you have to use a condom because I don't know what you can give me that'll harm me. You know, I talk to cab drivers about AIDS. You know, and I talk about this upper middle class that we get into that doesn't want to hear, like you say, go home and tell these 20-year relationships that we need to practice safe sex, baby, because there's an epidemic going on out there. We don't want to hear that, but you have to do it. And you know, there are like videos out. There are little pamphlets and things that give suggestions on how to bring the subject up in the bedroom or wherever. Don't wait until you're getting ready to make love to whip it out and say, hey, look. Yeah. You don't wait to that point. You know, you bring the conversation up casually at dinner some kind of way.
That's right.
You know.
Thank you. I just want to say that I hope she doesn't have her ears burning, but I'm very proud of my second daughter, who's 29 years old, married to a Marine captain. You know the type? Okay, so last Christmas she told him, darling, we're going to start using condoms. Well, I won't tell you what he said, but it took them several months. And of course, she didn't run home to tell Mama. She told me this a long time ago. You're my mama, not my sex therapist, okay? But around March, I happened to call her up, and my little granddaughter was playing on their bed, and she had this harsh voice, stop that, don't touch that. So I said, what did she do? She said, well, we have this little cute little box, a little wicker box here, and I keep the condoms in it. I said, oh. I said, how did that go? Well, whose idea was this? She said, well, I mentioned it around Christmas, and just now it's settling in. But she finally, and I'm saying that because it's personal. I said, you got to make it personal. I'm not going to ask you how many of you insist, like Donovan said she insists, or she demands. How many of you are using condoms now? It's important. You can't say, well, we've been married, not great. I didn't ask you to hold your hand, but that's wonderful. It takes guts. And what I'm trying to say is, yes, we didn't know before, but now we know, and there's no excuse. You can make it playful. You can make it joyous. If you've never really opened up a condom and put it on a guy, you need to practice, and you need to watch your fingernails. Take off your rings. And I've got a little article out there. I hope you pick it up before you go. And I say those same things to physicians, because they need to demonstrate it to people, the pediatricians, the family practitioners, the psychiatrists, all of them. But what we can do is to buy some rubbers, and don't buy the cheap ones. There's some that have a chemical that is helpful for the AIDS virus. We can't say it stops it, but it's worth it. I even saw some, I was out in St. Louis, saw Village briefly, but I was at a Planned Parenthood conference, and there was a big display of something called King Condoms. Well, now, I've got some beef with the condom people about whether or not they're really big enough for some men, and I think we need to talk about that. I think they need to research it. But some men will not use them if they think they're going to break or embarrass them or something like that. But there are many other things we can say, but it's the woman's role too. And out of just sheer apathy, ignorance, innocence, you never bought a condom, you never opened it up, you never put it on somebody, then you've got some homework to do. Mm-hmm. Or stop having sex. Mm-hmm. And so I'm joyous about it. I say use the condom. It's at least safer. Safer sex. Did you want to say something, Miss, about this question, what sisters can do? Yes, please, Miss Loretta.
I had a question. First of all, I just want to say how touched I was in reference to hearing you talk. And when I came, coming here, I wanted to know about women. How do you reach them? Because in the program that I'm with, and consequently I'm in the same program that Donna is an outreach worker, I work with the same project in New York. And wanting to start a support group, wanting to know where to get these women, and wanting to know how would I go about finding them. And that's a question that I wanted to ask the women who spoke in reference to having AIDS?
I think that's a wonderful question. Unfortunately, we are out of time. Donna, Missy, and Cheryl will be here. Okay. And so if you would just network with them, they are going to participate in the first group session, and they have to leave after that. Yes, it is.
How can she get the other women with AIDS, you mean?
Yeah, how can we find out where they are? Yeah. My suggestion was, could we begin to answer them in the work groups?
Okay.
Because of the timing. And we'll be together at lunch this afternoon. All right. Okay. Good enough.
Me personally, I guess you would have to start in hospitals, in jails, the hospitals, drug programs where people are trying to clean their act up and don't know where to go or who to turn to afterwards, referrals from doctors. There are a lot of places out here. That's where the woman would have to deal with that on her terms first. It took a while for me to, you know, because I ain't want everybody in my business and knowing this and knowing that. But some things you'll do to survive. And I sort of figured my confidentiality was not all that important when I was trying to get my life, save my own life. It's going to come out anyway. And I had a support group that Denise helped start at the house. And I had family and friends, but think about these women out here, got kids, babies. They can't come out of the projects because they can't get on the bus. You know, it's a lot of different ways. And I think us as black women, we network and get our little system together just like white women do. Yeah.
The only thing I was going to say is, if you decide that you want to run a support group, and then the thing is to just put your notices out, and you have to be committed to just be where you say you're going to be for those women to show up. I went down to the parole board, not parole board, the probation office, and a gentleman there told me 100, out of 100 people that they test anonymously, 30 of them come back positive. And these people have nowhere to go. So I've got notices down there that on Thursday nights there's a support group for women, and hopefully one day they'll start coming in. And like she said, the clinic's just wherever you can go. Put the notices up, and maybe someone will respond. Mm-hmm.
I also want to add that the same model that works for these women is the same model that we use in the National Black Men's Health Project for us to come together. Part of Denise's success is Denise herself is in a self-help group. Like I am in a self-help group. I'm in two groups, one at work and one outside of work. That's the first part of it. Because what you learn is what it takes for us as black women to come together, just whoever we are. And we start with three people, you and two other people. Listen to what Donna said. She started a group with her and there was one woman. That's success. The next week it was another woman. That's success. It doesn't mean that you gotta have 40 people at the beginning. Most support groups don't function real well when they're bigger than 10 or 12 anyway. So what you wanna do is it's exactly the same principle. So it might be that one of the first things you might wanna think about is organizing you a group yourself. Then you will understand how hard it is to be in one. And you will understand about confidentiality, and you will understand about giving it up, and you will understand about doing the analysis. So, you know, let us remember what we said. How will I be in a group myself? And then it will help with other people coming together.
One final comment right here, and then we really should break. Well, this is just a comment, but I want to address this to Donna. I'm a family physician, and you made the statement that physicians have been very cold to you. And I just don't want you to go away thinking, or any of you all thinking, that all physicians are like that, because I'm very supportive of you. And you also have, as far as I can see, Ms. Arts, another physician, Dr. Gertrude Hunter, with the National Council of Negro Women. I can understand what you're going through. I myself personally took
annual leave because administrative leave was refused to me to come here. I was told by my superior, who was a white male, to get my priorities straight. And my priorities to me are straight in terms of being here. And I was asked by Denise to come and participate. And when she told me about the national project, I said, by all means, I'll be there. And so I don't want you to go away thinking that all positions are like that.
Thank you.
Help me if we could just take a minute, and if the person on your right or your left needs a hug or a hand or something, that we would take some time and just come together.
please.
All right, I know you don't want it. But.
Because
I need it, okay.
I'm getting ready to go right
over
here and
do this. Well, you didn't give me a hug, I gave you a hug.
Okay.
You stay well now. Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
I want to talk to you after this before you leave.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
I was at Planned Parenthood. Now we're going to, because I'm the associate.
We're
and she'll be assisted with the recording by Dorothy Stevens from the Public Health Service. Dorothy?
Yes.
My roommate over there with the earphones on, right. And the Blue Group has a card. Because today, you're going to be in the Coffee Connection, which is downstairs on the first floor, but tomorrow you'll be in a different room. So that'll be in the Reed's room, and I'm not sure where that is, but we'll find out and let you know tomorrow. Okay? We want you to move very quickly to your rooms, and I'm going to take away for being the guy, the woman that says about the time. I'll be the heavy, because at the end, we want you to feel like you've had the time. So all jokes aside, move quickly, and we're going to keep everybody here and keep all this good stuff going.
Okay. So I'm recovering.